we're spending the hour on diversity and inclusion on college campuses in Wisconsin. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the aftermath of George Floyd's killing by a white police officer, university administrators straight across the country, they released statements condemning racism. But those statements are just one piece of this. Are you a student or faculty member? What is the climate like on your campus? Is there tolerance and acceptance of people from different backgrounds? Are you distressed by instances of microaggressions that you can point to? We're at 800-642-1234 throughout the hour. Atira Coleman is Associate Dean for Student Success, Equity, and Community and the Director of the McNair Scholars Program at Beloit College. Atira, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the invitation.
We also have Kimberly Barrett, Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion and Associate Dean of Faculty at Lawrence University. Kimberly, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me this morning.
And Cheryl Gittins, an assistant vice provost at UW-Madison, who will officially become the interim chief diversity officer later this week. Cheryl, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Cheryl, let's start with you. How should colleges and universities be responding to this moment? Because there is an opening for conversations that maybe haven't happened in the past.
That's exactly right. The first way that I think college campuses need to respond to the current climate is to respond with an approach of care, with a listening ear, leaning into uncomfortable conversations, leaning into the ways in which racism has created conflict on our campuses, or in our towns, or in our communities, in our families, in our lives, historically, and how our systems currently may be impacting the experiences that our staff, our faculty, and our students are facing, and really leaning into those conversations in a manner that we would want to act to change. At UW-Madison, that's one of the things I think I've seen the entire campus community lean into first, opening up opportunities for listening sessions with faculty and staff, processing spaces for students, holding several forums, and a call to action even program. We have about 1,700 people registered for a call to action seminar we'll be having this week with folks around the national conversation. To just think about where do we go from here and how do we make an impact on our campuses and the ways in which we really envision engaging diversity and embracing diversity as a strength, a core strength of the educational process.
But having a listening ear, Kimberly, can be difficult. It can be painful for some groups. How do you approach this conversation, especially for people who are white, talking about race and racism, when they may have not acknowledged that history or even that understanding of what it feels like to be a person of color?
Well, I think this moment in history, you know, following the murder of George Floyd, which we all saw over and over again on our televisions, really provides an opportunity for people to, you know, get involved in this conversation in a way that is productive, that gets us from the denial of saying I'm anti-racist to being in a position where we want to do something about it and act in ways that are anti-racist. So I think that what we all need to do is be clear about what our purpose is, what our shared goals are, and what the ground rules are for our engagement when we have these conversations. I think that we really need to be focused on listening to each other, hearing the stories and experiences of people in our communities, at our universities, and then go about the, you know, difficult task of changing these systems that have been very hurtful and, you know, oppressive to people in our society.
Well, Atira, what are the ground rules for these conversations at Beloit? How have you approached the conversations, you know, following George Floyd's killing?
Well,
we've kind of had a system in place in terms of initiatives and professional development, things such as sustained dialogue, decolonizing pedagogies for the last couple of years to kind of impact, you know, these types of things. But I think with more recent events, we've realized that we need an entire kind of systematic change. We need to create an infrastructure that kind of supports these efforts. And we believe that that starts with ensuring that our senior administration is operationalizing what we even mean by being an anti-racist institution, and not keeping these efforts in sort of like a siloed offices or departments, but threading them through the entire institution. At first, I think we came at it as, you know, what's one or two things that we can fix to be more inclusive? And as we did that, we kind of realized the enormity in which racism and anti-Blackness are ingrained in so many of the institution's practices, policies, and curriculum and culture. And so what really needed to change was things at the systematic level, ensuring, you know, that people weren't complicit, ensuring that there wasn't a lack of accountability, and ensuring that we had clear goals and a direction for actually creating an anti-racist institution.
We're talking about race and inclusion with three university officials whose job is to encourage inclusion on campus. We are talking with Atira Coleman there from Beloit College, Kimberly Barrett from Lawrence University, and Cheryl Gittens from UW-Madison. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Atira, I want to pick up on something you said there. What does decolonizing pedagogies mean?
It means ensuring that when you're being inclusive, it's not always about who's just in the room. That's a part of it. But, you know, being at a predominantly white institution, it's also ensuring, you know, whose knowledge are we prioritizing? What theorists are we teaching? What perspectives are we encouraging that our students consider? And so we have these conversations and these seminars and workshops with faculty so that they can ensure that their syllabi are inclusive as well, that they're bringing in a diverse lens into their specific disciplines.
Cheryl, UW-Madison is just steps from the state capitol, the site of mostly peaceful protests, some violent ones too. How are you addressing the issues raised by Black Lives Matter, even when you look at proximity to where you are?
Again, I think that what we're doing on our campus is leaning in from the top down, from down up, and from side to side, engaging all communities, all those who really want to tackle the difficulty of dismantling racism and other systems of inequity on campus. I can tell you that our campus leaders from Chancellor Blank on down recognize the need to do more and to do better. And at our university, and all people matter, and Black Lives Matter. And we recognize that.
Atira Coleman there, Associate Dean for Student Success, Equity, and Community at Beloit College. Cheryl Gittens, Incoming Interim Chief Diversity Officer at UW-Madison. We have Kimberly Barrett with us as well, Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion at Lawrence University. How do you think social justice, racism, and police brutality should be addressed in college classrooms? Do you think universities should be vocally supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement, or should they stay a neutral party? Be part of this 800-642-1234. Back in a minute. More conversation here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about equity issues and how diversity officers are preparing for new conversations this fall on college campuses. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. After the death of George Floyd, UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank wrote a letter to the campus. It said, in part, To our Black and Brown students, staff, and faculty, I want to say unambiguously, you belong here, you are important to this campus, your lives matter, and I am committed to your safety, unquote. Do you feel you belong on your campus? Do you talk about race and identity in your classes? How do you teach about unconscious bias? Time to talk here, 800-642-1234. We have three diversity officers this hour: Cheryl Gittins from UW-Madison, Kimberly Barrett from Lawrence University, and Atira Coleman from Beloit College. Let's take a call now. Rob is with us from Radisson this morning. Hi, Rob.
Good morning. Thank you for the program. I've been waiting for a long time for this program.
Good. Thank you.
My suggestion would be every American needs to sit themselves down in front of a mirror. It has to be in front of a mirror and ask yourself two simple questions. Number one, who gets to pick their parents? Number two, who gets to pick their color? Nobody I know. So it makes us look very foolish to being racist against one another, because we couldn't change who we are or what color we are or what parents we have. Nobody can do that. I think Michael Jackson tried. It didn't work out too good.
Rob, thank you for that comment. I want Kimberly to address this in terms of identity and how that identity is formed at a young age.
Well, and identity is both a combination of some sort of intrinsic things in terms of who we feel like we are and what we see reflected back to us from society. And this concept of race, many of us mistakenly think of it as something that is biological, when in fact it is something that we created culturally in its modern form, probably in the 1600s, when people from around the world were here in the Americas for the first time living together. And we wanted to support a certain or justify a certain economic system and a certain power structure, which ended up being white supremacy. The economic system was slavery. And so although there are no markers that differentiate different groups of people by skin color, that's like thinking people are fundamentally different because of the color of their eyes. We created this story, this myth of race, to support the idea of white supremacy. And so our identity as individuals are formed in response to sort of these cultural dynamics around race. And they've been embedded in our education systems in terms of what we learn about and what is omitted, in terms of our social structures, our governance structures, even our economic system still. So identity is really a combination of both how we see ourselves and what we see projected back at us from society.
Atira, do you want to jump in there in terms of what someone sees when they look in the mirror?
I think you kind of touched on it earlier in the fact that when people of color, Black and brown people, when they look in the mirror, they learn at a very early age that, you know, that they're different, that there might be people in this world that just don't like them just because of how they look. And I think that this is the time where now white people are looking at themselves and realizing that they have certain privileges that others don't have. And so I think that is something people need to interrogate to really get to the crux of the problem. Because as certain people have privileges and kind of rise up, the way that our country works, that also disenfranchises other groups of people. And so I think that interrogation is very important, and that self-reflection, I think, is key to actual change.
Cheryl, what are those conversations like around white privilege, and how can you go there and constructively come out of those conversations with actual change?
Well, thank you for asking that question. As my colleagues have said, an internal and introspective look at self and your learned behavior from a perspective of power or position is an important starting point. On our campuses right now, many people are really engaging in opportunities for self-reflection, conversations with one another. It's been very important to create spaces for white colleagues to come together and discover things about themselves, lives, and history. After all, we aren't actually taught some history. To think about that and think about how it's applying to the way people live their lives and power is applied and structures are developed and policies are built. So there's a lot of reading going on. People are collectively asking for, you know, how can I engage in the conversation? Are there texts that I should read, people I should talk to, things that I can listen to? How can I better understand my own biases? This is the way that I see most of our colleagues engaging. And what I'm most proud of is seeing how people want to lean in and act. What can I do to help change the system, to dismantle the current system, to be better, to do better? And that comes from my own learning and self-reflection first. And that's, I appreciate what I'm seeing.
Yeah, not a one-off conversation, but a journey.
Correct.
I want to switch gears here and look at policing on college campuses. Atira, a few years ago, Beloit changed its policy regarding when to call police to campus. Can you tell us what changed and why?
I mean, what we're seeing right now in the context of police brutality is not the first time that this has kind of been the increase, and we've seen it a lot in the media. And so several years ago, when this became kind of such a viral thing, we kind of disconnected from the Beloit police and we limited their presence on campus. And so students are told, you know, if an emergency or something happens, they call campus security. And that allows us to ensure that, you know, our campus security and who we're hiring and who are in these positions to work with our students are being properly trained and understand our anti-racist missions and the way that we aspire to be anti-racist. And I think the overall culture has changed in the sense that students understand that we see them, especially our Black and brown students, that we see the fear that comes from police because of what they're seeing on TV, because of their interactions, because of their experiences. And so I think they welcomed that change. And it also allows us to kind of build more of a community. When you have this kind of trusting community, people are more inclined to call in security if something is wrong or they need help. And they don't have this fear that whatever is going on is going to be made worse or further escalated by calling the police.
So you feel it's working?
Absolutely.
Kimberly, you know, some people fear the police for very good reason, as we've seen through history. How has Lawrence worked with law enforcement on its campus? What is that relationship like?
Well, our campus safety officers are not licensed police officers, and our students actually have a very good working relationship with our campus police. Our campus security officers. We do training and work with them, but also we work with the Appleton Police Department. In the first year that I was on campus, we had a series of three-hour dialogues between the campus and the police to open up lines of communication so that we could have more of a relationship of community policing rather than, one of just people being seen as enforcers and only interacting with the police when people were doing something wrong. And so we do not have licensed, you know, police officers on our campus. So that makes the dynamic a little bit different. But we have been working closely with the Appleton police to make sure that they're seen as someone who is protecting and supporting and serving our students rather than, strictly being people who enforce rules and, give consequence to rule breakers. So we've really tried to take a different approach.
We have three campus administrators for the hour on the topic of equity and diversity. We have Kimberly Barrett there, Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion at Lawrence University. Cheryl Gittens is incoming Interim Chief Diversity Officer at UW-Madison. Atira Coleman, Associate Dean for Student Success, Equity, and Community at Beloit College. How should administrators handle racist speech on campus? Should it be protected by the First Amendment? Should officials create a safe space for people of all backgrounds and ethnicities? Join in. Time to talk through this. 800-642-1234. We'll pick up this conversation right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We're discussing diversity and inclusion and the efforts by campuses to help faculty, staff, and students feel safe and feel welcome on their campus. Beyond the statements from college presidents, what concrete strategies or steps will address racial inequities on campus? How is the campus climate where you are? Has it changed in recent years? Reading in the Chronicle of Higher Ed yesterday, it says colleges are in for a racial reckoning. And the question posed was, what would it take to really address the role that colleges play in perpetuating racial inequity? Join in on this, 800-642-1234. We have Atira Coleman, Kimberly Barrett, and Cheryl Gittens. They're diversity officers and administrators at Beloit College, Lawrence University, and UW-Madison, respectively. I want to ask you, Cheryl, on the issue of policing. UW-Madison has its own police department, and some years ago, campus police were criticized for removing a black student suspected of creating anti-racist graffiti from a class and arresting him. Did that incident prompt any changes to UW police policies and strategies? Cheryl, can you hear us? Looks like we're having...
I apologize. Oh, you're okay. Actually breaking up, so I couldn't hear your question.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and I was asking on the issue of policing on UW-Madison's campus. Some years ago, campus police were criticized for removing a black student and arresting him from class. Did that incident prompt any change? And I think we've actually lost Cheryl. I want to go then to bias incidents. And actually, let's take a call here. Ray is joining us from El Monte, California. I understand, Ray, you're driving through Wisconsin?
Yes, I'm approaching Madison.
Ray, what is on your mind about diversity and inclusion on campuses?
Okay, it's not just campuses. And I'll try to make this as quick and brief as possible. I look at it as we're all one race. No matter if your religious background, where an ultimate creator created you, if you're an evolutionist, where we all came from single-celled organisms, whatever. We're all the human race, but there's ethnic background. And so it's like, to me, it's ethnicism. And the 2 points a friend and I may he rest in peace. We had another person we knew that not only working with us, he was a police officer. And no matter how much we argued with him that we're all the same on the inside, we all have red blood, we have pink organs, we all have muscles, he just would not believe it that no matter how much we argued with him, if you weren't white-skinned, you were different.
Ray, thank you for bringing this to the table. I want to ask you, Atira. Ray is saying we're all in this together. We all have the same blood and organs. Can that be true, though, and possible in our society? Can we see that we are all in this together? Is it possible?
I think it is possible, but what I fear is that when some people say that, you know, like we're all the same, we're all in this together, what they mean is, you know, that we should all assimilate to kind of this, you know, white centric, middle class, aspirations. And I think we can all be in this together, but also respect our differences and our different cultures and our different ideas, and our different lens in which we bring to the world. And so, yes, I mean, race is a social construct. It was created to divide, as, you know, the colleague Kimberly stated. And so many people buy into the fact of these differences to the point where they think they're biological, and we aren't taught that they're not. We aren't taught kind of the history that would help people understand why we see some of the economic differences, why we see some of the differences in society and how people are viewed. So I think it is possible, but I think we have to unlearn a lot. And one of those things is that we all have to be or look the same in order to be in all of this together. We can do that while still holding on to our culture and respecting our differences.
Kimberly, I want you to jump in here. Is looking at biology alone too simplistic? What else do we need to do?
I think that one of the main drivers and one of the main factors that maintain this racism and prejudice that we have is missing education. We don't have a complete history of our country, of our laws, of our legal system, so that people don't understand how we became so different, how we came to have inequities in terms of income, inequities in terms of health outcomes. And so then people automatically assume that it's somehow because we're fundamentally different, not because of the system. And so I think that's why this idea of anti-racism that's being talked about so much today is important. It's so that we can understand the systems that maintain our individual biases, our individual prejudice, that then, you know, it's sort of a cycle that then creates behavior that further sustains these systems and prejudice and implicit bias. And so I think one of the main things we need to do is to have more complete education where everybody is seen, included, and we talk about, all aspects of our history, not just the things that maintain sort of these myths and values that we have related to a meritocracy or equality. How have we fallen short of those things? And we have to understand that first before we can understand that we are all equally fully human.
Let's look at system more closely here, bringing in David in Milwaukee. Hi, David. What are your thoughts?
Hi. So what I'm hearing a lot is great, and I really appreciate everyone. The thing I'm worried about, particularly with the UW system, since I'm a student at UW-Milwaukee, is that I'm seeing a lot of discussions about this, but I'm not seeing it really happening at, like, the macro level where there's funding going to people who are studying race. I know, like, Women and Gender Studies Department, their funding has been cut year after year, and other, you know, programs that deal with race have experienced the same thing. So I want to know how universities can put some of the funds back into this critical research that we're doing, and not expecting individual professors to talk about these issues, but rather creating systems at the university that can deal with these issues.
David, thank you. Cheryl Gittins at UW-Madison, could you field that?
Hi, David. Thank you for your comment. I really appreciate it. I think that we're really at the moment where research in these areas are greatly valued. And I think we're in a position to have greater conversations about the value of efforts on campus to study inequity, racism, and other forms of marginalization, bias, and prejudice. Is at the forefront of the conversations, and at the forefront of conversations in faculty departments, is at the forefront of thinking about how faculty members or researchers receive funding or are considered or valued as scholars. for their contributions in this work. So I think we're at the right time. We may see some change in this area, David. So I thank you for bringing it up, and I think it's something to bring up on your college campuses. I foresee some change in this area. I definitely see these conversations taking place on UW-Madison's campus in the academic department.
Atira, I want to ask you, you know, these conversations may be inside liberal arts and humanities classes. How do you have these difficult conversations in the hard sciences, in the math and the chemistry class? Where do you go?
And I honestly think that, you know, equity and kind of anti-racism, they thread through all disciplines. I think that that is a common misunderstanding that these types of things can only be talked about in certain disciplines. You know, previously I ran an undergraduate research program where all of my students, whether they were STEM from the humanities or social sciences, had an equity lens in their work. So when we're talking about health disparities in by, like, you know, different racial identities, that happens in STEM, but you have to understand those inequities first, and you have to have the lens to see that that's a problem and want to solve that. So I think for Beloit, it's realizing that we can't silo these efforts, that we have to prioritize them. And as brought up by, you know, the question of like funds, I think a lot of institutions are struggling to have effective resources for a lot of things. But when we think about kind of equity or anti-racism as just an initiative versus an institutional aspiration, when things get hard and resources are low, that's sometimes the first thing to go. So I agree with Kimberly that, you know, there's being a change in the conversation, and we're realizing how we do have to thread this institutionally. And I think with that conversation comes the resources to support those efforts, the infrastructure to support those efforts. And when it's institutional, those conversations happen everywhere, regardless of major or discipline.
And they're not exactly tied to a specific budget line that could just get cut at any time.
Absolutely.
We're looking at diversity and inclusion on campuses in our lives in Wisconsin. We have Atira Coleman is Associate Dean for Student Success, Equity, and Community at Beloit College. Kimberly Barrett, Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion at Lawrence University. And Cheryl Gittens is Incoming Interim Chief Diversity Officer at UW-Madison. Are you a college professor? How have you talked to your students about social justice in your classes? Will you do anything differently when students return to campus or return to your online lectures? Still time to discuss. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute. More conversation here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. One question here is, how do we achieve real diversity and inclusion in higher ed? People have challenged building names and statues at institutions around the country. What will conversations be like on college campuses this fall? Have you participated in unconscious bias training? What were your takeaways? Still time, 800-642-1234. We have Cheryl Gittens, who is Incoming Interim Chief Diversity Officer at UW-Madison. Atira Coleman, Associate Dean for Student Success at Beloit College, and Kimberly Barrett is Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion at Lawrence University. They stay with us. Kimberly, Lawrence has a Diversity 101 toolkit. Can you explain how that's used?
Well, we try to make information available so that people at all levels of this journey, people who are just beginning, people who have been doing this for a while, can find something to help them move along in terms of building their cultural competence. And so we have a number of articles on our website that supplement the work that we're doing throughout the university, whether it's, you know, classroom work that we're doing in terms of inclusive pedagogy with faculty, decolonizing the curriculum, student organizations that might want to be allies, or the work of people who identify as white who are doing anti-racist work. And so this is just, you know, one piece that anybody can access on campus or in the community that supplements the work that's going on throughout the university, throughout the campus, and even in partnership with the community and the region.
Let's bring in Rocky now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Rocky.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I appreciate your show and that you're trying to help with diversity and people getting along. It's nice that you're doing it. I've got a question about, you know, if you're going to have security on campus, how is it different having a policeman compared to a security officer? There's someone there trying to protect you. Seems like at times you need a policeman more than a doorman for enforcement. And isn't it possible to get policemen or security that are, you know, of dark skin so that
Cheryl,
you see somebody your own?
Yeah, Cheryl, I want you to be able to field this because we weren't able to connect with you on policing on UW-Madison's campus. What would you say there?
So what I know about our police department, we hired a new chief officer a few years ago, Chief Roman. And, you know, one of her goals is to become a national model for how campus police should train and perform their duties or roles on campus. So recently they've laid out a plan, an action plan that meets these guidelines around Campaign Zero, the hashtag 8 Can't Wait project. And the goal is to assess needed changes in the department long-term and short-term that will ensure the police department demonstrates its commitment to racial justice and in the ways that they engage community members on campus as well as in the community with a particular angle to ensure building community with marginalized groups. So
I want to touch, I want to look at free speech here for a moment. And Kimberly, you know, from a private college standpoint, you may have more leeway to control speech on campus. What approaches have you and Lawrence taken with speakers who may push ideas that would be considered offensive?
Well, I think, challenging people and their ideas and current way of thinking is central to learning, right? And so, being uncomfortable is part of that. And so I think people should expect to be uncomfortable. There's a difference between presenting challenging ideas, speakers who, present thought that is a little different or very different from what you think, than being in a situation where you're harassed and shut down. And so I think that, like all universities, I think most of them at least, we value academic freedom in terms of the freedom of our faculty to, pursue various research agendas, ideas, express those ideas and new finding, create new information. However, we have to create an environment where everybody feels like they can be part of the conversation. And so that's where there are limits to free speech if that speech becomes harassing and creates a place where, people are threatened directly or indirectly. And so, I would say we have a number of ways that we deal with that in terms of we have a bias incident reporting system. We have a non-discrimination policy. We also have Title IX harassment related to sex discrimination, so prohibitions in that regard. And we also this summer will be starting a task force looking at hate speech. How do we prevent and respond to that?
Atira at Beloit, you know, what is it like there for you as you try to balance First Amendment rights with the need to protect victims of hate speech?
I mean, similar to what Kimberly was saying, we have a number of ways that we handle this. And so in terms of, we also have hate and bias policies, different ways that students, faculty and staff can report these types of incidences. But something else that we've tried to do in terms of kind of being on the offense of this is instilling the skills and tools of community transformation, as well as conflict, you know, solutions and how to deal with different types of conflict, how to have these hard conversations. And so we do that in a variety of ways, with increased sustained dialogue, with workshops, specifically with faculty, staff, and students that focus on how conflict is treated differently, how someone's positionality impacts how that conflict is understood in terms of power and privilege. And we found that giving people those tools makes even really hard conversations, really uncomfortable conversations. And again, that's different than hate speech or, you know, things that are, you know, harassment enticing, but really hard, difficult conversations. It makes it easier for people to do that. We understand how we have to do kind of inner work to understand our own perspectives and our own lens in order to truly understand someone else's lens. And you might not always agree, but I think in an academic setting, different perspectives are what we should be striving for. That's how innovation happens. We all can't be thinking the exact same thing, but we do have to protect our students, especially the ones on the margins, from any sort of hate speech that would hinder their ability to thrive educationally.
But these difficult conversations are best, I would imagine, Kimberly, when they're in person. What happens if college courses go online for the fall and you can't have these difficult, soul-bearing conversations one-on-one with students in a small gathering?
Actually, you know, I've been surprised at how well we've been able to use the technology and the tools that have been available for us this past term. For example, at Lawrence, you know, when right after the George Floyd killing, we had a sort of campus-wide discussion via Zoom, and we're able to break into small groups, you know, do an introduction at the beginning, break into small groups so you could have more intimate conversations with, you know, 3, 5, 6 people, and then come back together to debrief. And so I think you can use technology sometimes to make it easier and safer to have these conversations with larger groups of people. So I think you can do that in using technology or whatever tools you have available to you at the moment.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you
for having
us. Thank you. Kimberly Barrett, Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion at Lawrence University, Atira Coleman, Associate Dean at Beloit College, Cheryl Gittins, Incoming Diversity Chief Diversity Officer at UW-Madison. Just ahead, it's On Point. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.